Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Episode Forward Thinkers. Mein Name ist Daniel Fürk und ich spreche heute mit Stefan Lindström. Er ist Finnlands erster Ambassador of Technology und kümmert sich in seiner Rolle um die Vermittlung von Werten im Umgang mit Digitalisierung, Transformation und Innovation. Gerade erst hat er auf dem Web Summit in Lissabon gesprochen und ich konnte ihn während der Slush in Helsinki treffen. Ich wollte von ihm wissen, warum die Rolle eines Ambassador of Technology überhaupt Sinn macht, welche Aufgaben er tatsächlich hat und warum Finnland irgendwie immer so einen kleinen Schritt voraus zu sein scheint, wenn es um Digitalisierung und den Einsatz von innovativen neuen Technologien geht. Wenn dir diese Folge Forward Thinkers gefällt, dann folge uns bei Spotify, Apple Podcasts oder wo auch immer du gerne Podcasts hörst. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Stefan, so nice to meet you here in Helsinki. One day after Slush, busy weeks, Web Summit, Slush, a lot of tech events taking place. Welcome, first of all.
Thank you. Sorry about the weather, but it's called Slush for a reason.
Well, it's better than last year. Last year we had like heavy snowstorms. This year it's like rather moderate in comparison. Yeah. Technology, you just mentioned you're basically selling values, and I really like that. So what would you say, why does a country like Finland need an ambassador for technology?
Well, it's not only Finland that has one in today's world. It's most of the sort of, should we call, developed tech countries have one. And it's also for a reason in a sense that when you look at it from a holistic point of view, so what drives in today's world foreign policy, security policy, trade policy, human rights, ultimately even democracy? It's technology. Technology and science is in the core of everything, and we need them people who look at it from a sort of big perspective view from above, what is really going on in the world. And the other issue then, what you mentioned, are the values. So what values do you stand for in that whole process? Because we have then three kind of fractions in a way. We have the European way of looking at it, where we put the consumer in the middle. We have the American way, where we empower the consumer, and we don't really care about those rules in that way. And then we have the third one, which is the authoritarian countries that use data to control their people. And my job is then, to a very large extent, how do I transmit, how do I sell our values to the countries that have not yet had that decision to make, meaning the whole of Africa, virtually the whole of Asia, the whole of Latin America, and then make cooperation with them so that we can work on a good level, bringing these things forward so that they benefit the citizen, the people of the country, and not only the system.
So we are talking a lot about AI over the last years and how it developed and how it went totally crazy. And now we are also talking a lot about ethics and then AI and how are we going to deal with that? Are there any borders we have to set? And in a sense, we can only properly do that if we have like an international understanding of how we want to use these technologies. So is this maybe something where a role like yours comes into play in like kind of delivering exactly those values? How are we dealing with that to also deliver that to other countries and see where it goes?
That is the meaning. AI is, of course, a typical example of that technology evolves so fast today that we don't know where it's going. I mean, AI as such is just a gigantic black swan. And it's very difficult to regulate a technology. What you have to regulate is the use. And then it's also an issue about who follows the rules and who don't follow. And then we come back again to exactly that kind of equation, that you have some countries that, of course, they are setting some rules, but they're not following themselves. We in Europe tend to be more the sort of basic obedient citizens, that we also try to live by the ethical rules and so forth. But would that mean at the same time that we are left behind in the development of all these issues? And it is in today's world that I sometimes joke and say that every single organization with any kind of self-esteem has created their own AI guidelines. But are they really followed? I don't think so. But having said that, we need some guidelines for the future. But we don't know exactly where we are at the moment yet, because everything is evolving so fast.
Whenever I'm talking to German politicians or people within the government who are working on digitalization topics, and I'm always bringing up like examples from the Nordics, from Scandinavia, Finland, Denmark, Estonia, and so on. And then I always hear the same argument. It's like, but they are such a small country, and it's so much easier in a small country to do digitalization, to do e-government in the right way, and so on. But what would you say to them? Is size actually an advantage, or is it just about how to properly scale technology?
I think it's more scaling and a willingness. If there is a will, there is a way. There's no question about it. But there are so many politicians who don't want to see and understand these issues today. And when they don't understand, it's very difficult to convince. Just as a practical example of that, when our new parliament came into seating, we organized a program with some colleagues on tech for the new parliamentarians. And evidently we started on too high of a level, because the first question that came after 2 minutes was that, excuse me, sir, what is a semiconductor? And when you don't understand even the basic concept of the technological world, then we also realized that you have to bring down the whole thing, in a sense that how do these things affect all the other things? What is a value chain, and how does it work? And what benefits can technology and digitalization bring to the society? And what savings can it bring to the medical health system, for instance, or many other things? But this brings me to the key point in everything, and that is continuous education. We have to educate ourselves all the time in bringing in new technologies, new ways of digitalizing the way we work, we live, we consume. Because if you don't do that, there are always people who are going to prey on those people who are afraid. And if you don't understand how digitalization works, how technology works, how AI works, you start doubting. You're afraid. And I understand these people very well. They are afraid for their job. This abstract thing called AI is going to come and take my job. And they are afraid for the kids' future. They're afraid that they don't understand. And then you have some populist politician who comes and say that I speak on your behalf. And then they start following him. We have these people in Finland. We have them obviously in the US. We have them in UK. We have them in Germany. We have everywhere. But the key point here is really the continuous education, that we have to educate our people all the time so that they understand what is going on. It's not easy. It is really not easy. But that's the key to everything.
I think it was in 2018, I had a conversation with Thomas Hendrik Ilves, former president of Estonia, and he kind of used this, the exact same argument you just did, with like political willingness in and also an interest in technology, trying to understand technology and educate also politicians on technology to make the right decisions. He already stated that like many years ago, it's close to 7 years ago now. Is it really true that there is no change happening, that people are still not understanding what we are talking about?
Yeah, I think it is. And there's also, of course, the educational gap and a generational gap. But ultimately, it's also a question about trust. If you don't trust the government, that the government is there to do something good for you, then it's very difficult also to embrace what technology does. And I many times say that I have three guinea pigs that I follow very closely, because I have two sons who are 15 and 18, and my father is 84. And to look at how they look at technological developments in a totally different way is mind-boggling. And there we go, in a sense. If I can explain to my father what I actually do, then I'm already on the winning side. But it's not easy. He's an engineer, so he at least has the basic concepts of it. But it took a long time before he sort of embraced the smartphone or any of all these other things, because it was still easier to just lean on the things that you knew and you trusted the way they operate. But now he's tech savvy and on board again.
I did a lot of conversations with people from Finland who are working in corporations here, and or even I told you we did an episode with Mikko Duffa of Citra, and we also talked about innovation in Finland and how it works and why it's different, or why it might be different. And I had a conversation with the former CDO of the city of Helsinki about a year ago, and we also talked about it. And I was like, in that conversation, there was at some point in time, I realized what might be the actual issue when it comes to the interaction between citizens and the government and e-government, especially in Germany. Because whenever you here in Finland are talking about the government, it's always kind of us. We are doing something. We are going forward. We are introducing a new technology or a new application or a new process or whatever. Whenever you hear people talking about the government in Germany, it's always they. They in Berlin, they are doing something. It's this disconnection between the citizens and politics. Is that something you can also kind of relate to? Something you also see?
You're really onto something there, because it the first thing that springs to my mind is sort of correlation to the European Union, how people embrace the Union. It always, when it's the problem, it's the Union's fault. But if there's a possibility or I can get money, it's a good thing. And a little bit like that in that sense. But it's all, again, we come back to the question of trust, is that do you trust the government for doing, are they doing this for something good? And then one example is our taxation system in Finland, which is fully digitalized. I don't file my taxes anymore. I get a suggestion, and if I don't have anything to add or deduct, then if I don't do anything, that's it. And 90% of the people don't have anything to do. So they know everything about how much do I earn, how much did I pay taxes, pension contributions, how many shares do I own, how much dividends did I get. Everything is fully embraced in that system. And that means that we trust it. But if you're working on the gray market, then of course you don't trust it. But it's the same thing. We also have the highest level of trust, I think, in the European Union, in the police and in the armed forces. And when that trust is there, it's so much easier to operate. And the only problem is when you have individuals or groups that are trying to erode that trust in some way. And because then you are always in difficulty. But it's also a matter about, I normally say in my job, the key issue is storytelling. You have to create a story that tells the picture, what benefits does it bring, and who are involved, and why are we involved in this thing? Because that resonates so much better than just sending out a public information pamphlet or God knows what. Storytelling. Tell the people, why is it good for the citizens? Why are we doing this? And bring some practical examples, and it will work so much better.
We've seen thousands of startups and investors coming here for slush over the last couple of days. What do you think, what is Finland maybe doing differently when it comes to supporting startups and when it comes to also building up relationships between startups and established corporations here?
When you look back at slush and the origins of slush, it's kind of mind-boggling, because it was basically two individuals who both had made big exits, two gaming companies. And they had a lecture to engineering students at the Aalto University. And they asked them sort of after the lecture that, so how many of you want to be entrepreneurs? And there were maybe five hands out of 500 coming up. And they looked at each other and said that we have to do something about this. We have to create, again, a kind of a story that being an entrepreneur is something good. It's something positive. And I sometimes call them business rock stars, because they have that kind of charisma, aura, like a rock star. And when that change happened, in a sense that they showed that this is what you can be, it's cool to do these kind of things. That's when it really took off. And now when you go to the technical universities here in Finland, there are these incubators, these accelerators around every corner. Just at Aalto, I think there's four alone. They travel around the world, they do anything. And ultimately, slush was born out of this. And slush is run by students. The whole operation, with almost 10,000 people involved, including all the volunteers, it's all student-run. And it's also been like a gigantic tech university, because if you look at what slush has produced after that, many of the people who have been CEOs of slush as 22, 23-year-olds have started their own companies. And now Mickey Kuusi's Volt is of course the prime example because it was sold for almost 7 billion after 5 years of operation. And Mickey ran Slush for 2 years. And everything what he learned, he sort of embraced. How do you deal with the investors? How do you scale? How do you do all these things? And then he utilized all that information what he had. And now, of course, he has had tremendous success. And what does he do now, which is another typical Finnish thing, is that he gives back. He has created funds that invest in startups. He has created chairs in professorships and things like this. This is also something that I'm pretty proud of about Finland. Supercell, for instance, is 80% is owned abroad. But they say that we are not selling the company and the tax domicile stays in Finland. So, and they are still one of the biggest taxpayers in Finland in the history. And now the last example is Silo AI, which is then an artificial intelligence company, also about 5 years old, sold for 650 million to AMD a couple of months ago. And immediately when the transfer went through, the CEO of Silo, Peter, announced that he's donating 11 professorships to technical universities in Finland on AI, just to give back. He has enough money for the rest of his life and for his family for the rest of their lives. So he wants to give back in many different ways. So it's a different kind of attitude for these young people to look at these things, I think. And that enables the whole tech ecosystem to thrive in a way. The other thing is also that Finland is a very small country. I mean, we have just over 5 million people and we don't have a gigantic internal market. So if you want to be successful, you have to go outside pretty fast. And many people that I have been talking to in my career, I lived 9 years of my life in California. And that dynamism is, of course, smittening in many ways. And many of the Finnish entrepreneurs that came there, I asked them, what would you do differently today if you would establish your company today? And they said that I should have come to the US much faster because the growth potential there is so much bigger. And of course, what we need to do here in Europe is to fix our internal market that doesn't really exist yet. And then we can start competing in a different way. And I think all the things that was listed in the drug report were really to the point. I was so happy to read that paper because finally somebody said how the things are and not how they should be. So far, we had a lot of people who are talking about building these kind of cloud castles and we are not getting there in any way. We really need to act now because otherwise it's too late.
You know, if you look at Germany, we've got, I would say, a lot of budget also government-wise to also support corporations to put money on technology and to kind of, yeah, try to support the development of certain technologies or something like that. Compared to that, Finland is a rather small country, as you said, and has a lower budget to also support corporations, to support the development of technology. How do you make sure that you're kind of betting on the right horse in the end when it comes to spending money?
Oh, we don't. We would be very successful if we would know that one. But the thing is also that this government has now made a very high goal in a sense that 4.5% of GDP should go into R&D. And as a small country, we have to do these kind of things to do. And this is something that we have done for a very long time, emphasizing that investment as such. The other thing is that you when you have then some small clusters, utilize those clusters in a way. So mobile phones is one, of course, that sprang out 35 years ago. Now we have really thriving clusters in satellite technologies, in quantum computing. And also on the AI side, because what drives it is that the government made these decisions that the fastest supercomputer in Europe is actually based in Finland. And when you have that computational power, it enables the companies to utilize it in a totally different way. If you're a researcher in the US and you want to have access to a high-powered computer, you have to wait for 2 or 3 months. So we can offer something what we call quantum as a service or HPC as a service, in a totally different way than before. And so it's governmental decisions in the past that are enabling these kind of activities to go on. But don't get me wrong, I mean, the government doesn't run anything. We just put money in a sense that the companies can do their R&D, we can support that. And when something comes up from there, then we can support them in that sense. But it's still the companies are the ones that are doing the business and see everything. And then it's also an educational issue. When you have a good, solid educational system, then that brings in all these people in a sense. But it's also like the motto of Slush, you know, what they say, that nothing beneficial have come out of being just normal. Be different.
If you look at Germany, then we are supporting corporations as soon as they are getting kind of successful or doing something groundbreaking or are getting into the newspapers and having a good story to sell. And here I always have the feeling that enablement starts way earlier. I just sent a couple of people yesterday to the Central Library here in Helsinki, because I'm always impressed by this whole thing where you can rent an audio studio, you can book a 3D printer, you can do whatever you want, and you can use all those technologies at a rather reasonable fee and do stuff you couldn't do because you wouldn't be able to afford those devices to buy them on your own. So is this maybe something that is like deeply rooted in the Finnish culture to enable people to do good stuff, also because you kind of have to do that, because otherwise nothing really would happen?
Yeah, maybe so. And it's also the attitude of the universities. I mean, it's really wonderful. I studied in the 80s and there were no possibilities like that, period. But in today's world, there are these accelerators and these common working spaces and where we have then like-minded people mixing. And when they have a good time and they see how these things work, they attract more people to come and share their vision and this. And the whole Aalto University, I think, is a prime example of this one. So Aalto was founded about, 10 years ago, when they had the Technical University of Helsinki, which was kind of the prime, the MIT of Finland. And then they added the business school there, the Helsinki Business School, to make engineers and business people to converge, because just that you're an engineer doesn't mean that you're a leader and you can run a company. It requires other skills. But more importantly, then they added the School of the Arts to the same university. So you had all the nerds, the money people, and the hippies joining together. And when you mix that in one sort of, you put one big churn and you mix these people, a lot of good things come out. So it's also the design, it's a way of critical thinking, it's environmental awareness coming out from this. So I think that kind of differentiation really works in many ways. And we dare to be able to think. I have a favorite motto now after coming back from the Web Summit last week, and say that you have to think outside the algorithm. Don't think outside the box, think outside the algorithm. Because if you're managed by an algorithm somehow, you're always controlled. And your internal sort of possibilities to develop something new is not there anymore. But if you do that, then it's a totally different thing. So think outside the algorithm.
But that also only works if you have a high amount of open-minded people and a high level of inclusion at the same time,
yes,
which might also be an issue in Germany.
Well, here it's also the issue that so I lived in Los Angeles for 9 years and maybe a mile from the UCLA campus. And what I always admired when you go there is that you have a mix of Asians, Latin Americans, Africans, people from any culture, any religion, from all over the world. And when you mix all these people together, there's always a good result, particularly when you add a lot of money. And that's the benefit of when you can attract people from all over the world to come in there. And now when you look at the universities here, virtually half of the programs at Aalto are English. They are taught in English. So anyone from anywhere in the world can come in. And you have thriving communities, like the Indian community here is doing incredibly well. And so they come here with their own thoughts, and then they are getting sort of more drawn into the whole ecosystem here, which they wouldn't perhaps have the possibility to do in India. And then companies come out of that, and it's really amazing to see. And the companies or the clusters I mentioned before, the satellite one and the quantum computing one. So it's the companies actually founded by foreigners who have come to Finland to study, and then gain the expertise here and go forward on that one. So talent attraction is also, and talent acquisition is a critical importance in that sense. But the more you mix, the better it will become. Crazy ideas come from not being normal, not thinking like everybody else does, and challenging, you know, the status quo.
Would you say that entrepreneurship in Finland is maybe more purpose-driven compared to more profit-driven entrepreneurship cultures?
I think that's a good way to put it. Of course, ultimately, everybody wants to make profit because otherwise you can't run a company. But we do look very highly into the sort of ESG basic values that are there. And some companies have also sprung out from that one. For instance, one that creates cloth from cellulosa so that we don't have this kind of gigantic mountains of cloth waste shipped to Africa. Because if it's made of wood, and it feels and operates just like any other t-shirt, these are the things that you can do in a different way. Or that you had a traditional paper factory. It's not really a paper factory anymore. It's a sort of giant biolab. And the majority of the products are associated to something totally different than actually cutting down a tree or making it to a wood plank or cellulosa. That's where we are going on these issues. And I think you're right on that one, that this has been sort of more purpose-driven than profit-driven.
A couple of years ago, I was discussing the like vague idea of why are we not introducing kind of a book of European best practices to share within the European Union to actually enable countries to better learn from each other. Because there are countries like the Netherlands, for example, they are really good at mobility. Then you've got countries like Estonia or Finland that are really good at e-government or the education system and so on. There are also things we are really good in Germany at. And we could actually be much better if we establish a proper way of learning from each other. Why is this still so hard? Like after all those years and all the experiences we had within the European Union?
Well, it's a question to, you know, my 9 years in the US have taught me a few things. And the one that I maybe treasure the most is the concept of give forward and pay forward. If I can help you, and it doesn't cost anything if I help you, why wouldn't I do that? In Europe, you don't really do that. Many times in the US, when you meet somebody, my name is Stefan. Next question, how can I help you? This kind of ideology, dynamism is missing in Europe in many ways. And it's also, we have a little bit of a sort of engineer mindset in a sense that we want to do everything ourselves. There is no vulnerability in many ways. So when I advise companies that are going to the US market, I say that the last slide on my presentation is I say that these three words are the most important in all this presentation. I hope that you actually take them into you. And that's ask for help. I have asked for help thousands of times. And in my career, nobody has ever told me no. Yeah, a lot of people have not helped me in a practical way afterwards, but nobody has ever told me to my face no. But you have to show that vulnerability and you have to ask for help in a sense of doing, how did you do that? Which lawyer did you use? What accountant did you use? How did you solve that administrative problem and things like this? How did you open a bank account? And by sharing this information, it's so incredibly valuable in many different ways of getting forward. But it's also in the mentality of the companies many times is that we had an example here where a company had a problem in their process with the water cleaning system. And so they set aside five engineers to create a working group and starting solving that one. And when we met with them, we asked them, Sarah, why don't you look into the Finnish startup community that are working on water filters and see if there could be a solution in that? They hadn't even thought about it. So they scanned the whole thing. In 3 days, they had identified three companies that could be there. And in 2 weeks, one company came in and they basically bought the whole thing and installed it. And then they started working with them, developing that product even further. And this is the way where we can go forward. Another way is something what I call grandfathering, is that when you have a company that does export, this means that this company is already successful in their own domain. And why don't they then talk to their own sort of value chain, the companies that are servicing them, saying that maybe you can also service our clients abroad. Take them with you and make introductions. So it's an attitude thing in a sense of what you do, and because you don't grow by just living in your own bubble.
Thank you so much for those insights. And I think ask for help is a good start. So maybe us German politicians are starting to ask for help within their own German ecosystem, but also within Europe.
And don't forget to also offer help.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.